You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Kia ora, morena koutou and haere mai. My name is Seb and you are listening to your new 11am weekly R1 Tuesday news show on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Unfortunately, my co-host got hit with the COVID stick, so cannot be in studio with me today. However, I'm wishing her a speedy recovery and very excited to have you in the booth with me next week, Nico. Coming up on the program, I Tenei Rā, we speak to the president of the Otago branch of the Tertiary Education Union about the decline in university enrolments that institutions across the motu have been witnessing this year and what this may mean for university staff. Afterwards, we'll hear from Otago politics lecturer Peter Grace on the ever-evolving situation in Ukraine and what can be done from a New Zealand foreign policy perspective. Then we'll have our local legends segment of the show, where each week we talk to one local business doing some good mahi. This week, Nico is talking to Thomas White of Otupoti's best vegan burger restaurant, Burger Plant. After that, I'm going to be chatting to my absentee co-host about the latest Jane Campion film, Power of the Dog, which took out an Oscar for Best Director yesterday at the Academy Awards. And finally, we'll have the Radio 1 Surf Report.
You.
But before all that, here is Troy Kingy and the Clutch with All Your Ships Have Sailed.
Mama told me I wouldn't know when I should quit, yeah.
That was Troy Kingy and the Clutch with All Your Ships Have Sailed. You're listening to the R1 News. Coming up, we speak to the president of the Otago branch of the Tertiary Education Union about this year's decline in university enrolment. But first up, here's Bonnie with the bulletin.
This is the news on Radio 1 91 FM.
Kia ora koutou, this is the Radio 1 News Bulletin. It's 10 past 11 in the morning. Call Bonnie Aho. Russian operations in Kiev have slowed to a stalemate ahead of peace talks. Sources say Russia is de-escalating its ground force in war-torn Kiev after weeks of attacks and refocusing efforts in the city of Donbass, which has seen pro-Russian insurrection for years. The Russian bid for Donbass has been taken as a direct attack on Ukrainian sovereignty. Meanwhile, US President Joe Biden is refusing to go back on his earlier off-the-cuff statement that Russian leader Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power. Biden has reiterated that the statement was not a policy call, but rather an expression of moral outrage. New Zealander Jane Campion's work on the film The Power of the Dog received the Oscar for Best Director last night at the 94th Annual Academy Awards. Campion's award comes 28 years after her first nomination for The Piano, and she makes history as the first woman to be nominated for Best Director twice. The Oscars ceremony has been commanding a different type of attention on the world stage after Best Actor winner Will Smith slapped host Chris Rock after the comedian made a joke about Smith's wife, actress Jada Pinkett Smith, who suffers from hair loss due to alopecia. Over 1,300 doses of Novavax vaccine have been administered since it was made available to the public 2 weeks ago, including over 1,200 first doses. The Novavax vaccine uses different technology to the Pfizer vaccine, which most New Zealanders have received. The Thames Coromandel Mayor Sandra Goody made headlines for refusing the Pfizer vaccine last year, saying that she would wait to receive the Novavax shot. However, once Novavax was announced to be made available, she told media she would not be getting it. There are approximately 3,500 New Zealanders dosed with the other alternative vaccine, AstraZeneca. The roads leading to Transmission Gully in Wellington have been blessed by Mana Whenua Ngāti Toa this morning ahead of the project's official opening. The ceremony was attended by four different Porirua mayors who have long awaited the opening of the landmark highway. Construction of the highway began in 2014 under John Key's national government and was scheduled for completion in April 2020, a deadline continually pushed out due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The concept of the highway connecting Wellington and the Kaipiti coast through Porirua was first mooted in 1919 by then local MP William Hughes Field. The new Dunedin Hospital will have piles laid within the next month, marking a significant milestone in the project's construction. The piles, made of steel, are being sent down to Dunedin and containers will be placed on the construction site to prevent noise pollution. That's the news. Now for weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
I tēnei rā in Ōtiputi, we have a high of 18 degrees, mostly cloudy, some possible drizzle lasting up until the afternoon. With light winds, we're looking at a low of 12 degrees overnight. Tomorrow is looking fine, morning and evening cloud. Northeasterlies developing in the morning, coming down to an overnight low of 13 for your Wednesday. And that's the weather.
Tēnā koe, Bonnie. Coming up, we've got Craig Marshall from the Tertiary Education Union to speak on this year's decline in university enrolment and what this means for university staff. Before that, here's Unknown Mortal Orchestra with Weekend Run.
We'll be right back.
That was Unknown Mortal Orchestra with Weekend Run. My name is Seb and you're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. 2022 is shaping to be the toughest year of the pandemic yet for universities across Aotearoa who are seeing fewer and fewer student enrolments. AUT, Waikato, Massey and Victoria Universities reported that domestic and foreign student enrolments had fallen compared to the same time last year. Otago has not yet publicly released enrolment statistics. These will likely come after the University Council meets in May. The decrease in enrolments poses a concern to the Tertiary Education Union, as staff cutbacks are likely to occur as a result of the declining enrolments. Earlier, I was fortunate enough to chat with the president of the Otago branch of the Tertiary Education Union, Craig Marshall. Here's our conversation.
Kia ora, Craig. Thank you for joining me. Would you mind briefly explaining to me what the Tertiary Education Union is all about?
Okay, so the TEU has been, it's been in existence for a number of decades now, and it's now represents pretty much all of the staff, or can represent all of the staff at most of the tertiary institutions, so polytechnics, Wānanga, and universities. Of course, I can talk about the University of Otago, where we represent both professional, academic, and general staff.
Craig, we don't have the numbers for Otago yet, but every other university across the Motu has seen a decrease in enrolments for 2022, which means that even if it doesn't hit Otago this year, it is likely to happen soon. Now, the unfortunate thing about all that lost revenue is the staff that these institutions are forced to make redundant. To that end, do you think that the university could be run on a more sustainable business model, one that is less susceptible to the fluctuations in student enrollments?
I'm not sure it's really a business model. The universities and the tertiary education as a whole is essentially constrained in its funding by government decisions. So they control things like how much student fees can be, what student fees are set, what contribution comes from the government to run tertiary education. So there's not a lot of space left for universities to change their income except by increasing the number of students. So if you're going to change the business model, it's really going to be changed to talking to government and saying you need to look at the relativities between what it costs to educate a student in New Zealand compared with what it costs to educate them in, say, for Australia or places overseas. So when there's a squeeze, and there's been a continual squeeze in that the increase in funding to the universities hasn't met the increase in inflation over the last 5 or 10 years. Costs have gone up more in that sector than elsewhere because it's quite dependent on overseas matters. So the universities are left in the position of saying we need more students. That's the only way that you can fund any kind of continued growth.
So the obligation falls then on the government to try and help and essentially protect these workers who are on the fringe of redundancy.
Well, when you look at the way that funding is set, it's hard to see where else it could go. As I said, pretty much all of the capacity to earn from the universities is constrained by government decisions. So it's not that they can go and find money elsewhere in any particularly useful way. So yes, I think it's correct. I think it is really a government matter.
Are there many other kind of campaigns that the TEU's involved with in regards to the pandemic and how it's affected university staff?
I think the TEU has done a very good job in trying to make people aware of what their needs and obligations are, both in terms of their own personal interactions with work, but also trying to make sure that the institutions are meeting their obligations. That's been a bit varied, but I can say that Otago has done a particularly good job of managing what is a really difficult situation. And I think they've done pretty well in terms of making it as, I wouldn't say pain-free, but as little pain as possible.
Well, I'm sure that's reassuring for all the students and staff of Otago.
Yeah. Well, as far as it goes, yes.
Craig, is there anything else you'd like to add along the topic of COVID and the well-being of students and staff in these tumultuous times?
Yeah, well, I think it's been really difficult. It is going to continue to be very difficult. It's difficult for the staff. It's difficult for those people who are running the universities. Of course, it's very difficult for students. And the big problem, I think, is the uncertainty and what's to come. Is that we do not know. For example, an Eastern interim solution to the problem of student numbers is international students. That's not a long-term solution, and we've already seen how vulnerable you are made when you make yourself dependent on international students and they suddenly don't come. Mm. So that's one possibility, and if international students are able to come to New Zealand this year, we might see some temporary easing. I guess that's a short-term goal. The long-term goal, though, is you need to think more carefully about how you're funding the system at all.
Wise words. Thank you so much, Craig.
Thanks for joining me. Righto. See ya.
That was the president of the Otago branch of the Tertiary Education Union, Craig Marshall. He was speaking on some of the impacts that this year's decrease in university enrolments might have. Coming up on the show, I'm going to be talking to Otago politics lecturer Peter Grace on the conflict in Ukraine and what can be done from a New Zealand foreign policy perspective. But first, here is Aldous Harding with Fever off Aldous's latest fantastic album, Warm Chris. Enjoy. That was Aldous Harding with her song Fever. I'm Seb and you're listening to the Radio 1 News Show. The time is 29 minutes past 11. If you've been following international headlines in any capacity for the last couple of months, then you'll likely be aware of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Around a month ago, in late February, Russia carried out what it has maintained to be a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The attack is now internationally considered as a war of aggression. The invasion of Ukraine is the largest conventional military attack on a European state since World War II. It has also triggered Europe's largest refugee crisis since World War II, with over 3.8 million Ukrainians leaving the country and millions more being internally displaced. To help explain the developing situation in Ukraine, we were lucky enough to talk to Peter Grace, a lecturer of New Zealand foreign policy at the Otago University's Department of Politics. He is also the co-director of the Otago National Security School and has recently completed his PhD thesis on early Cold War intelligence. Just before I play out the interview, I thought it would be worth mentioning that a development in the conflict had not yet occurred at the time of recording. Yesterday at a press conference, Jacinda Ardern announced that New Zealand will be sending 9 intelligence analysts to the UK and Belgium to gather intelligence on the war in Ukraine. The intelligence gathered by these NZ Defence Force staff would then be passed on to Ukraine's military to support its fight against Russian troops. It's really a shame that I couldn't get Peter's take on this development, but I guess that'll just have to wait until next time. Anyways, without further ado, here is my conversation with Peter Grace.
Kia ora, Peter. Thank you for joining us. Peter, for those who have remained unaware, can you give us a brief synopsis of the conflict in Ukraine? What were some of the contributing factors that led us to where we are now?
I ought to start with the caveat that I'm not a Ukraine specialist, and only fleetingly, because I did it in my master's, a Russian specialist. But I'll do what I can. So factors involved in the Ukraine-Russia dispute. Well, probably worth starting with the most obvious one, and I think one that's quite crucial to it, which is that Ukraine, the word Ukraine roughly translates to borderlands. So Ukraine was seen by the Russians as a stretch of land that was part of their defense system, and that dates back a long, long time. And so when you think of things like a sphere of influence, something that was called the borderlands is definitely in that category. And so there's a history of colonialism attached to Ukraine's story. No, so what you've got is a country that's pretty flat, grows a lot of wheat, so there's a lot of primary produce, but there's also a very considerable defence industry and tech industry, very, very high-tech industry in Ukraine. So the Donbas, which is the area of the east of Ukraine where the fighting has been going since 2014, and the Crimea also in the south, are very key to Russia's strategic needs. The Donbas is where tanks were made in the Soviet Union days. So, you know, from a strategic point of view, it's the worry that Ukraine is starting to shift away from Russia towards the West. And you see a very marked difference between East Ukraine, which has a lot of Russian-speaking people in it, and again, in the way that you have with the English and the Irish, you have these families that are Russians living in Ukraine and have been living there a long time. And then the West, close to Poland and Moldova, which are very Western-orientated, and historically Western and Ukrainian-speaking. So you've got a strategic argument, you've got a high-tech argument, and you've got a nationhood argument all happening at the same time. And so when the Russians talk about going into Ukraine to rescue Russian-speaking people, they're kind of serious about that, and they're also very serious about not letting Ukrainian nationhood thrive, because that means the further away they get from the Russian conception of it as a borderland. Now, on top of that, you've got other things happening. You've got Putin's genuine concerns about the West. When I say genuine, what I mean by that is they're quite rational concerns from his perspective, that the West is encroaching further and further into Russian old territory, and also showing Russia up. You know, Russia's a kleptocracy where the people at the top just cream off an enormous amount of money for their own personal wealth. And the idea that Ukraine would join the EU, which was mooted, has been mooted for a long time, is scary to the kleptocrats who might see a state of Ukraine actually doing better than the state of Russia. So there's another idea there about nipping it in the bud before it becomes something so blindingly obvious that one group of Russian people are living in a kleptocracy and the others are living in a democracy that's doing rather well, thank you very much. So there's that as well.
Right. So thank you for outlining some of those factors as to why we are in the situation we're in. It seems like a very complex conflict with varying opinions and factions, even within Ukraine, which obviously makes it a conflict with no easy solution. In your opinion, what are the solutions? And has the conflict already begun to show any signs of slowing down? I mean, NATO has recently estimated that there have been around 15,000 Russian deaths. Has Russia been unsuccessful in their efforts? Have they begun scaling back in any way?
I thought, like a lot of other people, that the war wouldn't happen, or that it wouldn't happen to the extent it did. And I've come around a full circle now, where I'm pretty much of the opinion where I started, which is we're going to see a split between East Ukraine and West Ukraine. And I think that's what Putin's probably likely to have to accept now, that he's going to say Crimea is Russian and the Donbass is Russian, and let Kiev and all of the cities to the west go. He's not going to get those. And there'll be probably a frozen war in the way that we've had since 2014 anyway in East Ukraine. But a frozen conflict that continues for the next umpteen many years, probably some sort of recognition that they've lost territory, and probably some quite a lot of flipping towards the west, joining NATO if NATO will let them, joining the EU, which seems more likely, and bringing all that tech strength that they've got, particularly in their produce. The other good thing that might come out of it is that Ukraine might be a better democracy than it was before the war. So that's my thing.
They're fascinating predictions.
More war, hopefully more democracy.
Yeah. You brought up this idea of Ukraine's assimilation into the West, essentially, into the EU, perhaps into NATO. The West is obviously in this situation in quite a tricky position. They've imposed all these crippling sanctions on Russia already, which have really damaged the economy of Russia and really.
Back on that now.
They're what? Sorry.
The ruble's returned to what it was, I believe.
Right.
So the Russians are managing their way out of that reasonably competently.
Okay.
Better than they have in war.
Yeah. Okay. So the ruble has stabilized, but it's kind of the West is stuck in this position, especially the US, where they. They're hesitant in escalating the conflict much further than economic sanctions alone. Recently, the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, he requested a no-fly zone over Ukraine. And Biden has been quite resistant to these requests. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, the argument against a no-fly zone is if you've got NATO planes enforcing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which you can't have a no-fly zone if you don't enforce it. Then they're in the middle of the battle, and it only takes one plane to get downed, either a Russian one or a NATO plane, and you have a world war on your hands or something similar. So, you know, that's why I've been careful about that. It's interesting, you know, there's been a discussion for the last couple of years about whether we're in a new Cold War. And a lot of people said, look, you know, don't even go there. It's not similar. But it is similar now. What we've got now is this very point that you're talking about, escalation and managing escalation, and that is what the Cold War was all about. So you're thinking about this with some degree of concern. Put it nicely. This degree of concern was what I was living through when I was your age in the Ronald Reagan years. That at any moment somebody might push the button and so we had a fear of nuclear escalation. We had a fear that anything could trigger a hot war out of a cold war. And you have to say that both sides, particularly the Americans, managed that really well and do understand what the rules of engagement are in the cold war. And I think what we're seeing now is that rule book being played out where you have discussions about nuclear, the use of nukes on a limited scale. You have discussions about policing war, stopping it from getting out of hand. You have very large-scale discussions about who wants to join our side. All of the Baltic states are now absolutely committed to NATO. Finland is discussing joining NATO. So a lot of people that were very busy trying to sit on the fence in the Cold War or on the other side and now it's flipping over. Really, Putin's having to live with the consequences of his actions, which is that he's created a situation now where a coalition is getting stronger and stronger against him. And I don't think that he thought that. I think he thought he was just going to get to push, and the coalition would just completely collapse. And that hasn't happened. It's gone the other way.
Hmm.
So when we're talking about worry about escalation, I don't see that as a worry. I see that as escalation being an instrument of keeping peace, which is if you threaten me, mate, I'll threaten you bigger.
Hmm. I want to bring it back slightly closer to home. Obviously, Aotearoa isn't part of the North Atlantic, and so we can't be as directly involved. But from a New Zealand foreign policy perspective, as that is your field of expertise, what can our government feasibly do to support Ukraine without escalating these tensions any further?
Yeah, okay, so going back to my thing, escalation is not a bad word in that regard. Escalation is part of the management of the process. And secondly, New Zealand is not part of NATO, but pretty close to it. We have a defence envoy in London who liaises with NATO, and we have quite a strong relationship with NATO. And not dissimilar to our relationship with Five Eyes in the sense that even though we are a member of the club with Five Eyes, it's part of that Western alliance that we have a relationship with. New Zealand can't do much in terms of the escalation part of it, except to try and slow things down. And to reiterate our role as a peacemaker, which, you know, at some points that seems a bit laughable that New Zealand, such a little state, puts its hand up to manage world issues like we did with Palestine not so long ago. You know, oh, we'll do it kind of thing, a squeaky voice. But on the other hand, the thing that's so good about New Zealand's foreign policy position is that it's consistent, and it actually has been consistent to going back to the League of Nations days. We've done a pretty good job of saying what we believe and what principles we hold dear and trying to keep everybody else to those principles. And Nanaimo Hussa, you know, I had some doubts about her ability to do the job, but I think those doubts are vanishing quite quickly over the last few days. But I think that in the past she's been trying to be careful to keep the government position, which was a little bit sitting on the fence, not going to commit either side kind of thing. That whole position is being whittled away quite fast with what's happening in Ukraine. New Zealand's definitely coming out and against Russia, against Russia's behaviour, I should say, and more with the Western coalition than we've been in recent years. So you know, New Zealand's got a good place to be able to remind the world that the peace that we've had since the end of the Cold War was a worthwhile peace that was based around some pretty good concepts about rules-based order and things that we needed, but we also lived and breathed.
Thank you, Peter. I really appreciate your wisdom and insight into this topic, even though it isn't your strength.
My bag. Thank you for asking.
Not your bag. You've been a wonderful help. And yes, please feel free to talk to us here at Radio 1 whenever you want. We'd love to have you.
If you're just joining us now, that was Otago politics lecturer Peter Grace speaking on the conflict currently occurring in Ukraine. Next on the show, we have the first installment of our segment, Local Legends, where each week we'll talk to one local business doing some good mahi. This week, Nico's talking to Thomas White of Otepoti's best vegan burger restaurant, Burger Plant. Before that, here is Hardy and Claire, one of my favourite Dunedin bands, with their song Bacterium. Look at your motor go.
What? naturally occurring phenomena. Bow to those pancake rocks and those Modaki boulders.
That was Hardly Unclear with Bacterium, Look At Your Motor Go. My name is Seb and you are listening to the Radio 1 News Show. On our first installment of our new small business segment, Local Legends, Nico, my co-host, who isn't here at the moment because unfortunately she's contracted COVID, but she spoke to Thomas White, owner of Burger Plant, which is a staple in the Dunedin food scene for both vegans and burger buyers alike. Here is their conversation on all things burgers and business. Enjoy.
Kia ora, I'm Nico and I'm speaking here with Tom, the owner of Burger Plant, a great food joint in Dunedin. This is our first segment of Local Legends. Here we go, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, I'm the owner of Burger Plant, yeah, just in North Dunedin.
Wonderful, and I'm going to ask you three questions just about your business for this new segment, Local Legends. Okay, so first up, what inspired you to start Burger Plant? Was there a hole in the Dunedin food scene, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think there was definitely a gap in the market for something that was fully vegan and as a fast food option. There wasn't really anything that was open past like 4 p.m. So for us, it was definitely a good gap in the market. Obviously, we originated from the farmer's market. So with the whole different idea of not really doing the burgers, but the burgers ended up being the main thing at the farmers market, and that's what led us to opening right in the heart of, you know, the student area, which was definitely the right place to be. I think there was definitely just a gap that we needed to fill, and obviously doing something that's a bit more sustainable, and yeah, just having us like a relatively young person running something that is also in the student area just was a good marketing place for us to, you know, market to the right people. So yeah, definitely think that was definitely a massive gap. I mean, obviously uni students are a lot more likely to be vegan or vegetarian, so yeah.
For sure, I can definitely see where you are now and how you got there. Yeah, thank you.
And when you create a new burger, and I heard you've just released a new one, Do you have a particular audience you cater to in mind, such as students or perhaps those who have a certain taste or enjoy a certain type of cuisine? Or like, walk us through your process of making a new burger and creation.
Yeah, so like, I mean, it's hard. Obviously, our target markets are completely different. Obviously, we've got students that have a lower, you know, income, so we've got to be wary of that. But then also having the general Dunedin public to try and cater to as well. So it's really hard to kind of make something that is accessible for both of them. Our whole goal at Burger Plot isn't to make things taste like meat. At the end of the day, they're never going to be meat. So we just want people to have a burger that they can eat it and, you know, enjoy the burger, and it happens to be vegan. So yeah, the process of it is just trying to like use a bit of my like chefing experience and like just try and look at like some trends that are going around, or just like kind of bringing different cuisines and stuff into a burger and trying to make burgers that are a bit different with, like, you know, adding different textures that aren't so associated with burgers, or, you know, different flavors that you wouldn't typically get in a burger. So yeah, it's making it a little bit more gourmet, but also having a decent amount of protein, so you're still kind of getting the right nutrients that you need. And that's kind of the whole goal, is just trying to make something that is just tastes nice, and that you wouldn't really like. I don't want you to leave here and be like, oh, that was vegan. I want you to leave here with that burger being just a burger that you've eaten, you know? Yeah, so not trying to push the mark too much. And obviously everything's made in-house, so all of our patties, all of our sauces are made here, which gives us, you know, a bit more free range in what we can do. But it does make things a bit more difficult at times, having to come up with a recipe, just because there isn't a whole lot of recipes about for things. So yeah, a lot of trial and error goes into the burgers.
For sure. Yeah, I love the different textures and sauces you have on your burgers. I think I've tried most of the menu now already, and they're great. They're great. I haven't tried the new burger, but out of ISO, I shall. Sure. What's the new burger called for everyone listening as well?
It's called Nuts For You. It's like our take on a satay, like chicken burger. Yeah, so it's really a little bit different, but yeah, it's made with Fix and Foss everything butter, so it's a bit healthier than a normal satay sauce, because it's got all different types of like seeds and like hemp seed and, you know, all that kind of stuff in the actual sauce. So it just makes it that little bit healthier.
Oh, exciting. Oh, I love Fix and Fog as well. I'll definitely check that out. And final question to wrap this up. You work in store right now. You are literally in store as I'm interviewing you.
Yeah.
What makes your day when you're working? Like, what brings you joy and makes your business worth it? Why do you love it?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's challenging at times. Obviously, at the moment with COVID, it's definitely been a bit of a damper of the mood. But I think the main thing, the reason that I am so into hospitality and into wanting to do something like this, is definitely for the satisfaction of like a customer enjoying the food. If they come up to me and say that was amazing or that was awesome, that really, like, you know, is a good feeling for that. And I mean, that's definitely what's like that keeps me going. You know, I have really good staff members as well, so they're always a good company to have. And yeah, that it's really like, it's nice to have people around the same age as you, and that, you know, I'm the same age as them, so it's a lot more relatable as a boss, that I can kind of, you know, ask how they are and like actually genuinely have a relatively good conversation with them. Yeah, but customers definitely giving their feedback is also awesome. Even if it's not the best feedback, it's still feedback, and that's something that we can work on, and, you know, we want to improve. So any feedback is good feedback.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, and thank you for taking time out of your work day as well for this interview.
If you're just joining us now, that was Nico, my co-host, talking to Thomas White, the owner of Burger Plant, talking about the ins and outs of what owning a business in Otepoti is like. Sounds like a really, really cool restaurant, Burger Plant. I'll have to try one of their burgers one day. Coming up on the show, my dear co-host Nico will be joining me remotely to talk about Jane Campion's latest film, The Power of the Dog, which has just won the Oscar for Best Director at yesterday's Academy Awards. But first, here is a song. This is Merc with the song Deep Dive. Enjoy.
So I follow you. One by one, streetlights become a pathway to your door. Over highways and concrete, lead me to your gate. Make my bed.
into sun or the shadow, and you look after me like a bird in the branches. When I'm not sleeping, oh, are you?
Good, everyone. If you're just joining me now, that was Merck with the song Deep Dive, and you've got it tuned to the Radio 1 News Show. Thanks for being here. Coming up on the show, I'm going to be talking to my co-host, Nico, who's currently in isolation. We're going to be talking a little bit about Jane Campion's latest film, Power of the Dog, which has just taken out an Oscar for Best Director at yesterday's Academy Awards. I've got Nico on the line here. Let's pray that this works. Nico, are you there?
Hello.
Yay.
Yeah. Yay. Hi. It's working.
how are you? How are things in isolation?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I'm excited to almost be out of isolation. But this is cool, being able to do radio from home.
The wonders of technology, eh?
I know.
So, Nico, you've seen Power of the Dog. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What did you like about it? And did it deserve an Oscar for Best Director?
Oh my gosh, I loved it. I did, and I think it is truly deserving of the Oscar and for Jane Campion to win the Oscar for the Best Director. I think that Campion did an amazing job, and her cinematographer as well was just absolutely amazing. They managed to create, like, The Power of the Dog is filmed in central Otago, kind of our backyard, which I love, and it's incredible to see, like, the beauty of the mountains and the backgrounds and, like, the still shots substitute for ranch land in Montana. Campion manages to create an image, like, stylistically, which is beautiful but so divergent from how I think would normally see and relate to just the central Otago landscape, which is amazing. It's really cool that she's been able to do that and achieve it to such a great extent as well. Yeah, Ari Wegner, I believe, is the cinematographer, and yeah, the expansive farmland. I just loved, as the viewer, being able to sit there in the audience and see this farmland, which seemed to go on forever, but also feel so claustrophobic in nature. It was very well executed. Yeah, you just feel pulled into it, into the tense relationships which populate the farmhouse. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but yeah, it's just the cinematography is amazing, along with the costumes and set design and the score. It's great. And yeah, there's also like recurring motifs. It's very thought out, and all of Campion's work is. So I'm not surprised really that Oscar. It was well deserving, definitely.
That's great. It sounds like you've done a lot of thinking about the film after watching it.
Oh, for sure. It's like, I think that I'm going to say this: you stay for the plot, and you also stay just for everything else that has going on, but there's a hook in it as well. There's a real good hook in the film, which is great, and it gets you thinking about it long after you finished watching it. That's why
There was a bit of a twist at the end, wasn't there?
Yes.
Bit of an M. Night Shyamalan twist.
You see it coming, though, at the same time, just with, like, subtle themes and, like, just the shots, which they used as well, are amazing. A kind of hint, I guess, towards the twist, almost. But it's a great watch, and I'll happily watch it again. And I recommend everyone to also watch it. Amazing.
Exciting. And that wasn't the only exciting thing that happened at the Oscars last night, was it, Nico?
Oh my gosh, no. No, it was not.
There were a few other events.
Yeah.
I think Bonnie covered them in the bulletin. And if you don't already know,
I think we already know that. But also the fashion. We didn't cover as much fashion in the bulletin.
Oh yeah? Who was wearing who?
Pardon?
Who was wearing who?
Oh my goodness. Well, Anya Taylor-Joy, one of my favorites, was wearing a beautiful look. Oh my gosh, was it Prada? It was really very dramatic. She was wearing like a veil almost. And then there was some beautiful Miu Miu looks. Sydney Sweeney was in Miu Miu and it was stunning.
So Timothy Chalamet, he was not wearing a shirt.
He was wearing, I think, oh my gosh, Balmain or something, but definitely check out the Vanity Fair articles of the Oscars red carpet after party. Beautiful.
I definitely will.
I will keep on talking, but I think that I shouldn't.
No, thank you. This has been a great film review turned quickly into a fashion review. It's where we work on our feet at Radio 1. hey, well, Nico, since I've got you and you're my co-host, I thought I should quickly wrap up the show. We've had a pretty action-packed one here on the Tuesday inaugural Radio 1 Tuesday News Show. We had, what did we have? At the beginning of the show, we had the president of the Otago branch of the Tertiary Education Union. He was talking on the decline in university enrollment rates that institutions have been facing and what that may mean for university staff. Then we had the wonderful Peter Grace, a lecturer at the Department of Politics at Otago. He was talking to us a little bit about Ukraine. Following that, Nico, you had an awesome pre-recorded interview with Thomas White of Burger Plan on our local legends segment of the show, highlighting cool local businesses. And you and I just talked a little bit about Jane Campion winning the Best Director Oscar. I think we didn't mention that she is the third woman to ever win that role.
Second time being nominated, but the third woman. And it's great for just New Zealand and our film industry as well.
Yeah.
Great recognition.
It's great for many reasons. How cool. All right, well, it's 12:05. It's a little bit past our end time. I'll leave it with... Who will I leave it with? I'll leave it with Lady Hawk. We like Lady Hawk, eh?
Yeah, I like Lady Hawk.
This is Lady Hawk, my love. You've been listening to the Tuesday News Show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1. Thanks for joining. We'll see you next week. Bye. Bye, Nico.
Bye.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.